From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, Making Contact. Looking forward to that. Here's what's happening. Peloton is voluntarily recalling all of its treadmills after the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission urged against using the company's Tread Plus machine following reports of a child's death and dozens of injuries. The recalls of about 125,000 units cover the $4,295 Tread Plus and the $2,495 Tread treadmills. Be very, very careful. Conservatives blasted Facebook and its overnight board for upholding an indefinite ban on former President Trump. This is a sad day for America, they said. Let's check in with Howard Bloom. Howard Bloom, what do you think of this, knocking the president off Facebook and keeping it?
Well, here's the deal. Former President Trump's Facebook account was suspended on January 7th. That was the day after the Capitol riot. And so was Mr. Trump's Twitter account. Said Facebook founder Ahad Bark Zuckerberg, we removed President Trump's account because we judged that the effect of Mr. Trump's postings and likely their intent would be to provoke further violence. Mark Zuckerberg has been under fire since 2016 over his decisions on which speech goes and which speech stays on Facebook. Some days his attacks come from the right, and some days his most vicious attacks come from the left. So instead of making the decision on whether to allow former President Trump back on Facebook by himself and taking a mountain of criticism on the chin, Zuckerberg appointed an independent oversight board to make the decision. Today, that board said that the Facebook ban on former President Trump should remain in effect until further decisions are made. This led to an immediate backlash from Trump allies high in the Republican Party, said former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Twitter and Facebook have two different standards. One for Donald Trump and one for everybody else. One if you're a conservative or a Republican or have a different ideology than them, and one if you're a liberal. Added Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Facebook is more interested in acting like a Democratic super PAC than a platform for free speech and open debate. Meanwhile, a Fox News headline trumpeted a Republican threat to amend current antitrust rules so that Republicans in government can take Facebook's business to pieces, theoretically removing Instagram and WhatsApp from the Facebook empire. Said Kevin McCarthy, if enough Republicans win election in 2022, the House Republican majority will rein in big tech power over our speech. But none of these threats against Facebook, Twitter, Google, and Apple, the four giants of big tech, are new. Ever since 2014, conservatives have complained that big tech is muzzling their freedom of speech. This is not true. Donald Trump Jr., Lara Trump, Ivanka Trump, Melania Trump, and Eric Trump all have active Facebook, Twitter, and accounts to this day. In 2016, according to The Guardian, big tech was targeted by players on both sides of the aisle as evil. In 2019, Shoshana Zuboff at Harvard Business School wrote a book taking aim at that came from the left. Meanwhile, the alt-right publication, WND, has attacked what it calls the big tech censorship of conservatives for years. But the real question is whether Donald Trump's postings are free speech or criminal behavior. Says U.S. Code 2383 on rebellion and insurrection, whoever incites, sets on foot, assists, or engages in any rebellion or insurrection against the authority of the United States or the laws thereof shall be fined or imprisoned not more than 10 years or both, and shall be incapable of holding any office under the United States. So the question is, was the invasion of the Capitol building on January 6th an insurrection, or was it a peaceful demonstration? If it was insurrection, was former President Trump the fomenter of that insurrection? In other words, is former President Donald Trump clearing the swamp and guaranteeing election integrity, or is he a danger to America's democracy? Mark Zuckerberg says he blocked former President Trump from Facebook because he feared Trump would, quote, use our platform to incite violent insurrection against a democratically elected government. Now, is Zuckerberg right, or is he simply smearing someone who disagrees with his point of view?
What do you think?
You know me, I'm a Democrat.
Yes, you are.
I'm horrified by this example of insurrection and by the intent that I know was behind it to create a wider rebellion all across the United States in order to hold on to office. Horrified.
There's a much larger story here, Howard, and we'll work on getting to the bottom of it, to be sure. Big story, though, but Facebook still kicking off former President Donald Trump. While his popularity of cryptocurrencies, especially Bitcoin and Ethereum, surges, Coinbase Global is at the forefront of the cryptocurrency industry. The company has a public stock, buy or sell. What are you going to do? Bitcoin plunged today. Let's check in with investment advisor Mish Shedlock. Mish, what do you think of cryptos? I'm skittish of these things.
I am. I've got a story on cryptos. First, let's talk about Coinbase. That's not a crypto. It's an exchange.
Right.
So they make money. You deposit money. You can trade in and out of your cryptos. They take a hefty 2 or 3% off of each transaction, so they're expected to make a lot of money. Now, how much money? It depends on how many people start trading cryptos, and more importantly, barriers to entry. As I see it, someone's going to come by, undercut them, charge a tenth of a percent rather than 2 or 3%, and who knows, that might be the end of their business. But let's discuss Dogecoin, and it's pronounced, it's spelled D-O-G-E coin. It was started in 2013 by software engineers, two of them, one from IBM and one from Adobe. They started this as a joke. It was a parody making fun of Bitcoin. So they launched this out. They bought the name Dogecoin.com. They stamped an image of a dog on it and put woof on the coin. These aren't physical coins. They're digital. Anyway, you know, they sold all of their Dogecoin and got out of it in 2015. They made enough, they said, to buy a used car. This year, it's up 10,000%. The market cap of Dogecoin is $73 billion, George. Elon Musk, for some reason, started tweeting about it. Snickers candy bar, you know, put a tweet out. We should just Dogecoin to the moon. Mark Cuban, the owner of the Mavericks, has been tweeting about it. All these people are hopping on the bandwagon here, and this is what the Fed has done, George. By making money so cheap, and then the government coming by and giving money to people for no reason that didn't lose their job and have income, people are speculating like mad. It's the greater fool theory on steroids, if you ask me, but quite an amusing story, George.
You got that right, Mish. Thank you so much. Within a couple of weeks at the most, maybe even days, the insect cicadas will emerge after 17 years underground. That's how long some of these things take. And many broods of periodic cicadas that appear on rigid schedules in different years. But this one, they say, could be one of the largest. They'll be in 15 states, all the way from Indiana to Georgia to New York. And they're coming out now in mass numbers in Tennessee and North Carolina. They're all over the place. I thought maybe if you didn't know what they sound like, listen to this. Now, when the entire brood emerges, backyards can look like inundating in waves, and the bug chorus, they say, is lawnmower loud. That's a lot. Up next, Space Force, our Star Trek future. Dr. Michael Sala joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Dr. Michael Sala, the pioneer in the development of exopolitics. He's the author of Exposing U.S. Government Policies on Extraterrestrial Life and Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence. Dr. Sala was an assistant professor, researcher in residence in the School of International Service at the American University back from 1996 to 2004. He has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland in Australia, founder of the Exopolitics Institute. Now, that's a not-for-profit organization that analyzes the political implications of extraterrestrial life. His latest book is called Space Force, Our Star Trek Future. It is book number 6 of the Secret Space Program series. Michael, welcome back. Always great to have you.
Aloha, George. Glad to be back.
How are things in Hawaii?
Well, the cookie frogs are very loud, so we don't need cicadas to compete with them. They're loud enough.
So we may hear them in your background there, huh?
You probably do. They are very loud in the background.
Tell us about the Secret Space Force. What's going on? You know, the President Trump at the time wanted to put the Space Force together. Has it started yet? Because it's kind of secret.
Well, it is underway. They have assembled a Space Force. They have given them the names, and they've started to rename facilities. They started to hand over some of the infrastructure from the Air Force Space Command. To start with, essentially Space Force today, as it exists, is really just the old Air Force Space Command, which has been redesignated. Space Force in the future plans to recruit people from the Army and the Navy and other services into their space program, and that would make it a much larger affair or much more significant. But at the moment, Space Force is still in consolidation. It is officially, it was set up with an 18-month setup period. So that 18 months pretty much runs out at the end of this month. So by then, Space Force should be fully set up and assume its responsibilities. And its primary responsibility right now is to protect America's GPS system, its satellite system, and, of course, the satellite systems of allied powers. So that's its most immediate goal right now. But it is looking at the future and looking at the growth of China and Russia's space programs, especially China, because that's where we get into the scenario of space becoming a warfighting domain.
Michael, will the Space Force recruit from the general population, people who want to just basically enlist?
Eventually, that will happen. Right now, Space Force is a very small affair. Officially, it doesn't have much of a Space Force. I mean, we're talking spacecraft. We're talking craft that can travel out into space and perform the missions that Space Force has. Officially, that is some years ahead. And you know, they're talking with Elon Musk and having his Starship become part of Space Force future operations, sending military astronauts up there into space, whether it's to manned space stations, or whether it's to go to bases on the moon. Those are the sort of things that SpaceX, through its Starship program, is going to help Space Force get out there initially. But what is the real space program is the secret anti-gravity craft that the Air Force had built decades ago that have been part of an Air Force secret space program. And right now, they are in the process of being reassigned, because what you have now with Space Force is that space has been redesignated from a benign environment. And in a benign environment, all you do is you conduct reconnaissance and you conduct covert operations using space. But now they're redefining space as a warfighting domain, which means that rather than needing, say, two or three squadrons of secret anti-gravity craft that go up there and do spy missions or maybe do some covert operations in, you know, countries like Iraq or North Korea, what you need now is 300 squadrons that are out there performing all the protective missions and to assert space supremacy. So that's the future. And so right now, Space Force is going to go through a transition. It'll probably take more than a decade. But I think as the public gets on board with the idea of space being a warfighting domain and that there's a real threat out there, then Space Force is going to start requesting a lot more money to build these up to 300 squadrons of advanced craft to go out there and do everything it needs to do to establish space supremacy against China, Russia, and whoever else or whatever else is out there.
I want to talk about that anti-gravity you talked about tonight, Michael, but 9/11/2001, that tragedy, of course, derailed plans to push the Space Corps, didn't it?
Well, that's right. Yeah, that was a really surprising thing in doing this research, because everyone assumed that Space Force was a kind of this idiosyncratic creation from Donald Trump, you know, from March 2018. But in fact, Space Force originates from a bipartisan commission that was set up by the Clinton administration. So President Clinton and Congress at the time and the Pentagon commissioned this bipartisan group of space experts that was headed by Donald Rumsfeld at the time to explore what the future national security requirements are going to be as far as space is concerned. And so one of their key recommendations was that there should be a Space Corps set up initially under the Air Force, but then eventually it would become its own separate military department. So that was back in 2001. And legislation was on the verge of being proposed by Donald Rumsfeld. And in fact, on September 10 of 2001, so that's one day before the big event there, Donald Rumsfeld unveiled his plans to give Congress his proposals for some innovations in the Pentagon, and amongst those was this creation of a Space Corps. But of course, 9/11 happened, and so everything was derailed, and so we really didn't hear anything serious about Space Corps or a Space Force up until the Trump administration.
That's pretty remarkable indeed, and of course, other countries are working on the same thing, aren't they?
Well, that's right. At the moment, Russia has a dedicated aerospace military department, kind of similar to Space Command. And China also has something similar buried within its PLA hierarchy, a space dedicated service within there. And other countries, Britain, Australia, also coming out with their own versions of a Space Command. I mean, the difference between Space Command and Space Force is essentially that Space Force does all of the training and it does all of the recruitment and provides all of the infrastructure for space operations. But Space Command has been set up to integrate the space assets not only of Space Force, but also the space assets from the Navy, the Air Force, the Army, and so forth. And so that way, what you have is an integrated operation in space that synthesizes all of these things. And so other countries are following their own versions of that kind of approach.
Michael, since you've been doing this, where do you get your information? Secret sources?
Well, it's a combination of whistleblower testimony, leaked documents, FOIA documents, and just news reports. And, you know, when you are looking at something like Space Force, because it is something that is so much in the public information pool, there's a lot of information out there that I'm able to look at and integrate with this kind of pre-existing body of knowledge I have in looking at what insiders and whistleblowers have been saying. I mean, the difference between what I do when I'm looking at something like Space Force as opposed to what, you know, many conventional academics or space experts would do when they're looking at Space Force is that in addition to looking at publicly available open source literature, I also bring in what the whistleblowers have told us, and I'm able to kind of like look at that, the deeper implications of, well, you know, what does it mean that the Air Force had developed decades ago these anti-gravity craft called the TR-3B that a number of people have come forward to describe as having been built and that they've been photographed. So a lot of people aren't looking at that kind of insider.
All right, Michael, hold on for a second. We'll come back and talk more about Space Force on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're back with Dr. Michael Sala, his latest book, Space Force, Our Star Trek Future. It's going to happen, Michael, isn't it?
Well, definitely we are going to enter a very exciting phase in human exploration of space. I mean, right now you have Space Force actively creating the infrastructure for a multinational effort to integrate space resources to not only colonize the moon, but also to start mining asteroids and establishing facilities on Mars. And I think what we have here is the foundation of different countries all over the world with space programs collaborating with one another towards these common goals. And if we're able to avoid the dangers of rival blocks, because right now, you know, this is a danger, because you have the U.S. working with its partners in setting up a multinational space alliance where they collaborate in civil and military affairs in space, and China doing the same thing with Russia, and they're asking other countries to join them. So right now we're on a kind of very promising but also very dangerous future, where the expansion into space in terms of greater numbers of people getting out there using the most advanced technologies and that becoming part of a trillion-dollar space industry or a space economy which integrates with the Earth and obviously bringing about a lot of wealth and resources for people on the planet. But also there's great danger too, because could we have a space war? Could we have the U.S. and its allies starting or being involved in a space war against China and Russia?
Or whomever.
Well, that's always the big question here is who might be the enemy that suddenly emerges. I mean, this is the big thing that right now the Pentagon and the intelligence community in the U.S. is trying to grapple with in terms of this report that the intelligence that the intelligence community is going to deliver to the U.S. Senate at the end of June. They're going to give them a comprehensive report on the UAP phenomena or the UFO phenomena, but in terms of, you know, does this constitute a national security threat? And it looks, based on all of the indications we're getting from the Pentagon, that they're going to frame it that yes, there is a genuine UAP threat out there, and we don't know who it is. And you know, so that lays the foundation for this new enemy that is like, well, no one knows what it is. You know, could it be China? Could it be Russia? Could it be extraterrestrial? Could it be some kind of interdimensional force? No one knows, but yet, you know, the Pentagon is saying that, you know, they're interfering with military exercises, they're interfering with land-based facilities, and so we need to counter that, and so you could actually have a demand for greater resources flowing to Space Force to deal with this new threat.
In your opinion, Michael, was Space Force being established as an offense or a defense initially?
Well, initially it's been established as a defense because, you know, going back to that space commission that was held that delivered a report back in 2001, they identified that the U.S. GPS system is critical for Pentagon operations. And if the GPS system was ever taken down, that the U.S. military would be crippled. And right now, the estimates are that about 70% of U.S. military operations are dependent on GPS. So protecting the GPS system is really critical for Space Force, and that really means that for the moment it's performing this protective function.
Well, everything depends on GPS these days. Air traffic, you know, our directions when we drive. I mean, we've become so reliant on it, haven't we?
Well, that's right, yeah. So, you know, right now, I mean, imagine what life would be like if all of a sudden GPS is knocked out. I mean, I remember the day, and you, I'm sure you do, George, when we'd get in our car and we'd get out our big book with all of the directions for what part of the city we wanted to go to. But now everyone just gets out their phone and, you know, and Siri will guide you there through the phone. But if the GPS system would go down, well, then there wouldn't be Google Maps or Siri telling you how to get to, you know, to A or B.
We're going to take calls with Dr. Michael Sala next hour here on Coast to Coast. Michael, the Secretary of Air Force at the time, Heather Wilson, imposes a gag order on talking about space. Why?
Well, that was a very interesting phenomenon because early on during the Trump administration, when he started to talk about the need for a space force, there was a gag order put in place by the Secretary of the Air Force, Heather Wilson, and she wanted to stop anyone within the Air Force talking about space as a warfighting domain because the strategic thinking in the military over the last few decades has more and more gravitated towards this idea that space is the strategic high ground, that China has recognized that is the U.S.'s Achilles heel because of its dependence on the GPS system, and that China formed a very credible threat in setting up space infrastructure to take down the U.S. satellite system. And so effort needed to be put into countering that, and so that's when the idea of a space force started to get a lot of backing. But the secretary blocked that, you know, by imposing this gag order, and that was really to kind of slow down this momentum towards the creation of a space force. Because, you know, believe it or not, there are very powerful people within the U.S. Bureaucracy that are opposed to the Space Force. You know, they don't want the U.S. to have a strong presence in space with a Space Force that aggregates all U.S. space assets under one military service and thereby implements transparency and accountability in how these space assets are being used. There are forces in the bureaucracy, let's just call them the deep state, or whatever you want to call it, the cabal, that prefer space to be this kind of nebulous, opaque, unaccountable environment where no one knows exactly what the left hand is doing and what the right hand is doing. So that's the way they preferred it. But Space Force was going to do the opposite, bring about transparency and accountability. And so the deep state was opposed to that. And I think Heather Wilson was part of that effort.
Michael, you mentioned anti-gravity, and every scientist I've talked to on the air denies that we have any anti-gravity devices. You think otherwise?
Definitely, yeah. You can go back to the scientific literature in the 1950s, and there were many scientific organizations that were actively researching anti-gravity. But then around 1958, everything went dark. And we know that there was active interest in anti-gravity because, you know, there were newspaper reports and journal reports and corporations were actively putting money into it. And then all of a sudden, it went dark. And I think that was because there was this classification imposed on the whole field. And that matches what with insiders and whistleblowers were saying happened throughout the 60s, that they saw these anti-gravity craft being tested at various Air Force facilities, and so this is where you have the whole reverse engineering of anti-gravity technologies that had been acquired by the Air Force and the Navy.
Now, your subtitle to your book, Space Force, you talk about our Star Trek future. Tell me about that.
Well, one of the really important things about Space Force and the momentum for that is that the people in the Air Force Space Command, which was the predecessor of Space Force, in October of 2019, they convened a workshop called the Space Futures Workshop, and that involved NASA, Air Force, Navy, the NRO, European Space Agency, and so forth, all coming together and brainstorming, well, what are going to be the major security threats in space in the next 40 years? So what will space be like by 2060, and what would we like to do? What would we like to create? And they came up with 8 scenarios, and the top scenario, the optimal scenario, was a Star Trek future, and that envisaged that across the civil, the commercial, and the military sectors, that all of these would flourish in space, and that, you know, what would be the kind of anchor to it all would be this multinational military space alliance. Where the U.S. would be kind of like leading an expanded global version of NATO, but this would be in space. And it would be very similar to what was depicted in the Star Trek series. And I think that was... I don't think it was accidental. I mean, it's on the record that that's what they want to create. But I think that the relationship between Star Trek and what we are now moving into in terms of our future and Space Force, I don't think it's accidental that we have so many similarities. You know, if you look at the logos, for example, between Space Force and Starfleet, they look almost identical.
Mm-hmm.
That's how, you know, there's strong similarities there.
Was Gene Roddenberry pulled in on some of this? Did he get inside information?
Definitely, yes. Gene Roddenberry, he was mentored by Leslie Stevens IV, who was the creator of the Outer Limits series that ran for 2 years, from 63 to 65. And in the second season of the Outer Limits, Gene Roddenberry sat in on many of the episodes that were being put together by Gene Roddenberry, by Leslie Stevens, and saw what Stevens was doing, was introduced to the actors and some of the assistant producers, and used a lot of them for the future Star Trek series. And I believe that was because Gene Roddenberry was being fed information about this future Navy secret space program that Leslie Stevens had been briefed upon by his father, who was a vice admiral for U.S. Navy intelligence and actually ran the Psychological Strategy Board, that was the top interagency board created to integrate intelligence operations across different military and civilian agencies. And they came up with the idea of using psychological operations to craft whatever desired outcome they wanted out there. So the media and Hollywood and the film industry was identified as one of the key areas for psychological operations. So this is fact. Anyone can check it out. The Psychological Strategy Board and the Robertson panel recommending using the media, the movie industry, for putting out its narrative. And Leslie Stevens was part of that, and he was directly influencing Gene Roddenberry, that they, in fact, had a secret agreement. So Roddenberry, Stevens never was given any acknowledgement by Roddenberry. That I think, was part of the deal, and Roddenberry is recognized as the creator of the Star Trek series, but I think Leslie Stevens played a big role in it.
Who is Lieutenant General Stephen Quast?
Well, he is a very interesting person. He is the modern day equivalent of General Billy Mitchell. And Billy Mitchell, he was famous in the 1920s.
He was a hero.
Exactly. Yeah, he was a hero. He was a strong advocate of American air power and the creation of a dedicated air force. And this was at the time when the U.S. Army had its own Army Air Service, and it was not at all open to the idea of an independent air force. And so it really squashed and really kind of repressed military officers that spoke about the need for air power. And kind of like, and eventually Billy Mitchell was forced, he was actually court-martialed because he was so outspoken.
There was a movie called The Court Martial of Billy Mitchell, wasn't there?
There was, exactly, yeah. Very, very famous movie. So Stephen Quast was someone that was the modern-day equivalent of Billy Mitchell because he was an outspoken advocate of the creation of a space force, that space power had to be created, an independent service was needed because you needed to have a military service that was focused on space as a warfighting domain. And because he violated the gag order that Secretary Wilson had imposed early on in the Trump administration, he was then essentially relieved from his command. He was a three-star general. It was assumed that he would get a fourth star and could even head the future Space Force. But because Heather Wilson removed him from his command prematurely and didn't reassign him, it meant that he was forced into retirement. So people refer to him as the modern-day Billy Mitchell because even though he wasn't court-martialed, he was essentially sacked from his position and forced into retirement.
Dr. Michael Sala with us. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about the book number 6, by the way, in his Secret Space Program series. This one is called Space Force, Our Star Trek Future. When we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast, we're going to take phone calls with Michael as we talk about the Space Force, things that you've heard us chat about. Jump on board and ask a question or two. I've got some more questions for Michael when we come back. And his books are all available at Amazon.com. Go to his website, exopolitics.org. Again, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Back with your calls.